You're listening to WIOX Community Radio, live and local in the Catskill Mountains, where we indeed are family. And that the last segment talking about the suicide rate in our region and the event on the 11th speaks to some of the challenges that families in our region face. But, you know, there's a great deal of concern about our children and teenagers in rural areas as well as elsewhere. And a lot of attention is being given to what is the impact of social media on our children and our teens. I mean, certainly social media has helped with connecting people around the globe. I just came from Montreal, the International Council of Nurses meeting, and everybody was on their phones. They were all tweeting out what they were hearing and learning and making connections with other people while they were there. But there are concerns about the impact of social media on our health and well-being. A recent survey conducted by Heart Research confirmed these concerns. And here to talk with us about that survey and about what can be done about these concerns is Jury Craig, resident senior fellow at the Institute for Strategic Dialogue. And she has a focus on digital integrity. Jury, thank you so much for joining me on Health Center in the Catskills Today.
Thanks so much for having me. It's a pleasure to be here.
So Jory, I want to start because I was so intrigued by your bio. It says that you focus on, quote, safeguarding democracy globally and the wider impact of online harms on society, unquote. And you, quote, advise global leaders on mitigating online harms, including work to advance tech policy reform and tech accountability at a global scale. I'm really interested in what you're doing and thought maybe you could just start us off with giving us a flavor of what all of that means.
Sure. So I've had an interesting career. I myself growing up in a digital age, and I am a trained public opinion researcher. So from the beginning of my career, for about the past 10 years, I've been spending time trying to understand the public. And really because of, you know, when I came into working, I was always really interested in looking at how social media was affecting everything we do in society. And so I've worked with elected officials and political leaders and media organizations and academic institutions and civic society organizations across five different continents to really research, measure, and try to understand what is going on in terms of how social media is affecting us, and particularly the harms that it's doing. And for me, it started a lot looking at elections and looking at democracy and ways social media was interacting with our freedom. But as time has gone on, it's become increasingly clear to me that this is having big effects on the future generations. It had a big effect on me personally as somebody who grew up with this technology. And so I've really become interested in just how social media is affecting young people, mental health in general, and that's led me to be involved in research like this.
And are you concerned about the influence of social media on everything? On our whole world? Yes? Tell me. Yes,
big time. I mean, you know, social media enjoyed a period where people largely saw it as something that was connecting us and making the world more global. But what we've seen is that notion of connection is actually a bit...
Oh, I think I've lost you.
You lost me?
Okay, I hear you. Go ahead.
You know, it's pouring rain where I am, so perhaps that has something to do with it.
I'm sorry.
It's all good. It's all good. Essentially, I was just saying that, you know, we have this notion in the beginning of social media that it was all about connecting people.
Yes.
And making us feel more connected to each other. But now research is showing that that's really a false notion. And social media is responsible for a lot of the negative feelings people are feeling. In some cases, it's connected to divisiveness in our society. But the most clear impact it's having is the one that it's having on young people.
Yeah.
And that is coming through in terms of how it's affecting their mental health and also how parents are experiencing challenges with just raising kids, you know, now that they have access to this social media.
So tell us about the Heart Research Survey.
Sure. So it was a survey of 1,800 registered voters nationwide, and that included 454 parents of children ages 6 to 17. We also focused on oversamples in five states, so Maryland, Michigan, North Carolina, Pennsylvania, Minnesota. And we were really interested in understanding how these voters and these parents were feeling about social media and the way it interacts with their lives. And there were a few really big takeaways, and I can say I've been doing research on how people think about social media for 10 years, and I've really never seen results that are just so unanimous across political ideologies and across demographics. And what the study is showing is that social media is seen as particularly harmful to children. Social media companies are unpopular, and this is really true across political ideologies and demographics. There's a wide acknowledgement of the mental health crisis that teens are going through. 98% of voters and 96% of parents acknowledge that there's a mental health crisis among teens. And the top two reasons they cite for what they think is contributing to that are connected to time on social media. So that's either the top reason that they cite, and this is open-ended, they offer this up, is a dependence to social media or a connection to social media platforms or a reliance on them, or cyberbullying. And bullying in general and shaming. And so it's something that came through really strong in the results. Another takeaway, there are sort of two other big takeaways. The first is that when we ask whether people think social media is seen as, you know, do the benefits outweigh the harms or do the harms outweigh the benefits? We see that when it comes to children and teens, 56% of voters say that the harms outweigh the benefits. Mm. And that's something that's changed over time. And so people's experience with the platforms are getting increasingly negative. Mm. And there's another, the final sort of big takeaway is what these folks want to be done about it. So majorities across ideologies want to see a candidate prioritize legislation that does more to protect kids online and on social media. That's, again, across ideologies, which is surprising. We don't often get things that are so unanimous across political ideologies. But we also see that parents are kind of, you know, still figuring out what they want to see done. So some of them say they want more tools, they want to be in more control, and some say they really just want platforms to be designed more safely. And if you look at the legislative landscape around the country, we're seeing legislation that is sometimes being proposed that has to do with giving parents more tools, and sometimes being proposed about really changing the way these platforms are designed so they have to be safe by design, so they, you know, are not dangerous in the hands of children who, say, maybe don't have access to parents who can spend a lot of time controlling the settings, et cetera. And that is a really interesting finding for us. And so parents are about split on whether they want more tools or they want to see the design change. However, when you ask them whether the tools are sufficient in keeping their kids safe, a majority say no. Mm-hmm. And they say that the platforms make it difficult and the tools aren't enough. And so what we're looking at is parents kind of and voters kind of saying the situation feels really hard and they want to see, you know, Congress, their state governments do more to make this a priority.
So, Jory, from your perspective, let's talk about the legislative piece first.
Sure.
What kind of legislation would be able to really diminish the impact, the negative impact of social media on children and youth?
Well, one thing that we're seeing around the world and in the European Union, they've already moved ahead with this type of legislation, and there are efforts here in the U.S. to do the same at the federal level and also at the state level. Legislation that requires the companies to conduct risk assessments. And these risk assessments would be looking at how do their product features, so the things that they put in place to try to get people to use their platform, spend more time on their platform, spend more money on their platform, how do all of those features correlate with risks? Risks including how do those pose threats to young people who might be vulnerable to, you know, certain health challenges or might get exposed to violent or dangerous content. And right now they're not required to do anything like that. And so first we want to see a risk assessment. It shouldn't actually be that complicated. And that's being baked into a lot of legislation right now. And then there are other pieces of legislation that require the way that the company decides to make business decisions to be under the scrutiny of having to uphold a certain safety standard. So in the same way we've seen other industries put safety standards in place and have to comply with them, even though maybe it costs them more money, that's sort of what legislation is calling for now. These companies should have to adhere to basic safety standards based on what we know the risks are, and they have to cooperate with, you know, whatever entity, whether it is independent researchers or others, to kind of share information with them about what those risks are and prove to them that they're adhering to these safety standards, which are still being established. And it's sort of at a different stage from state to state.
So you would almost need this to be federal, though, wouldn't you?
Well, it depends who you ask, but it would be great. It's kind of unprecedented, right? So if you think about, you know, the way we handle lots of things in this country, our education systems have differences at the state level, and then there's also federal standards. But yes, when it comes to product safety, we do usually see a precedent set at the federal level. But there are a number of federal bills that have to do with privacy, that have to do with transparency, that have to do with that safety by design that I mentioned, that are in motion. But then states are moving faster in some cases. So California passed bipartisan legislation, the California Age Appropriate Design Code, and that addressed some of those design systemic risks that I was talking about. So if the states move faster, I think that's great. I think really at this point we can see in our research that parents and voters are feeling exasperated. So whoever can move faster and really have comprehensive legislation put in place. These platforms have really enjoyed no guardrails for a long time of their existence, and it's just time that there's something that's actually put in place, at least for our kids and teens, if we can't do it for a wider society.
So it's not likely that anything would move federally. You're not hopeful that anything would move federally at this point.
Not unless there's more done to push it forward. Yeah. We've seen some really positive bills be put forward. However, with the state of legislation moving in our country generally right now, it has been hard to get something across the line. Something to protect kids and or something that has to do with privacy are probably the best bet, but there are a lot of positive movements in the state.
So I want to go back for a minute on the impact of social media on children. What evidence do we have about things like, as I was saying, we were just talking about suicide rate, the idea of depression, anxiety, what have you. What do we know about that?
So Jonathan Haidt, he has a wonderful, he's a researcher, he's an academic, and he has a wonderful compilation of what we understand now in terms of how has social media contributed to the rise of the teen anxiety and depression that we saw begin in the early 2010s? And there's a whole slew of research that is, you know, really connecting the use of social media with the changes in that mental health, in the mental health status of that demographic of girls in particular. And there's a slew of other evidence that is showing that there's a lot of problematic activity happening on these platforms. For example, we're seeing how social media algorithms will make recommendations that can lead young girls down rabbit holes that lead them to pro-anorexic content, or lead them down rabbit holes that expose them to content about self-harming. When it comes to young boys, there is evidence showing that social media companies are actively suggesting to them content in some cases that's very violent or, again, promotes self-harm. And so there's a bit of a lag between really connecting what is happening on these platforms with the full, you know, range of research that we would want to be able to see across the different areas of harm, because the platforms themselves are not so forthcoming with sharing data about what's going on on these platforms. And so the way we've received some of this information is in some cases, you know, by having to, require them to share it. And if they would be forthcoming, we'd probably have more evidence. But right now, there's a significant amount of evidence that is indeed connecting mental health, especially among young girls, with their time online.
I'm talking with Jory Craig, resident senior fellow at the Institute for Strategic Dialogue. Jory, if parents are listening, or we're an aging county, so a lot of grandparents here.
Sure.
And if there are concerns, when do you, what would you say to them about when to become concerned about your grandchild or your child's use of social media?
There is some prevailing wisdom out there right now about keeping kids off social media until at least after they're 13. I personally would be encouraging them to stay off social media for longer. Really, their brains are still developing, and we know that social media is designed to play on some of the systems in our brain. And I'm not a parent myself, but being, you know, again, somebody who has been online for a long time and has studied this for a while, I think that having a conversation is really important. And the solution isn't necessarily to keep them off, you know, through their entire teenage years, because they'll have access through their friends. And that's why it's sort of this balance of, you know, trying to keep them off while you can, trying to make it normal and create conversation about why it's cool and healthy to spend time offline. And really, really just trying to create a relationship of trust so the young person is more likely to share what they're experiencing online if they are exposed to something dangerous.
Mm. And the battle that the parent will do with the child who will say, I'm the only child that can't do this.
Right. And that's really challenging. And that's why it's not enough. You know, we're seeing in some states, like Arkansas and Utah pass bills that are really, you know, saying that if you don't have your parents' consent, you can't be online. And we have some concerns around that, A, because it doesn't make the social media platforms any safer for kids who maybe don't have parents that are paying that close attention, or maybe they just don't have that kind of guardian. But also, a majority of parents, when we asked, said they'd still let their kid on. And I know from doing qualitative listening and research that a lot of that is because they feel the social pressure of what other kids in school are doing, and they don't want their kid to feel left out. And that is a concern. And that's why it comes back to really calling for and having a conversation nationally and in communities about how these platforms should be safe by design. They should have safety standards they adhere to, so you don't have to worry that if you do give in, if your kid does find access to spending time on these platforms, that they're going to be unsafe.
So I don't have children either, and I have no idea how a parent would go about having control over a social media site that their child is on. Explain this to me. So I have a child who, let's say, has their smartphone and they're on Facebook. Well, they're not on Facebook. They're on TikTok, right? And Instagram. Is that where they're at?
Yes. Instagram, TikTok, indeed.
And so what do I do?
Well, you'd have to, on each of those platforms, navigate probably several steps to find the parental controls. Once you were in the parental controls, you'd have to navigate through several steps to figure out which settings are the right settings for your child. And the platforms really do like to, some of them are better at it than others, they like to offer these tools and highlight how many tools that there are. But given the way our information is moving and the way we're spending time online, you have to navigate that across several different apps. They all have different settings, and they're changing all the time. One thing that is really interesting about some of the legislation being discussed in Europe is they actually have a provision that says that the companies have to make it easy. They can't make it unreasonably difficult to find these settings, which shows you the fact that they're having to mandate it. It really shows you that the companies have an incentive to make it harder, because if they have more access to your child's data, if your child has more ability to move about their platform, they have more opportunity to, you know, put content in front of your child that allows them to make money off of those eyeballs and that attention. Mm. And so, you know, I would definitely have people in the industry tell me it's not that simple, but it does really feel that simple when you think about how across these different platforms, it's consistently hard for parents to find those settings, and it's consistently requiring them to check and check and check again. And even then, we know kids have ways around it. So that's why, you know, the people that are putting out proposals for more tools, tools will only get us so far. We have to make these products safe. We can't, you know, have to just constantly be on edge wondering if they're unsafe while they're spending time online. It's just too much part of how they're living now.
Jory, I would think that schools have a major role to play here in terms of at least talking with their students about the impact, what we know about the impact of social media on health and how to, and the mental health in particular, but also, as you point out, you know, I mean, anorexia is a mental health condition, but it so affects you physically. And it seems to me the schools have a really strong role to play here, but are they?
Well, it depends on the school, and it depends on the why behind that. There are several really strong programs by organizations like Common Sense Media and organizations like Fair Play, and they offer curriculums that schools can take on that show people how to be responsible on their time online. But in a lot of ways, a lot of the schools have seen, you know, technology has really benefited the way that their kids are able to access education, and so I'd say that it's really, really different around the country, depending where you are and what school you're referring to, in terms of whether there's any conversation at all about this, or whether they do have, you know, literacy programs in place and have a real emphasis. Certainly more has to be done. And certainly, you know, I'm sure teachers are dealing with and battling this battle kind of on their own in many respects, because there just hasn't been a standard precedent of how we're going to talk about this as a nation.
And are there best practices for schools? You've mentioned a couple. Common Sense is one source, but are there best practices out there that you think are really good?
Well, I'm not a teacher, so I think that, you know, my friends who are teachers would say, you know, the teacher should be the ones to say which are the best practices in terms of what works well in their classrooms for their students. But what I will say is, we know that trust between the adult and the kids is really important, and for the adults to really try to understand what the young person is experiencing, instead of saying, oh, it should be easy for you to be off that platform. Mm-hmm. Really acknowledging, like, you know, we understand it's part of your social fabric, and we understand that, you know, you've grown up with it. And then vice versa, we've seen that it is really helpful to have young people speaking to other young people about this. So you can imagine an older sibling talking to a younger sibling, or, you know, the seniors talking to freshmen, because they do just have a better understanding. So to the degree you can build, you know, a representative sort of education model where they are able to be taught by people they can relate to, that's really important here, because social media, they're not just accessing it for one thing. They're accessing it for their whole lives. They're crushed. They're, you know, when they're looking at the, you know, role models they want to be when they grow up, it's a very personal experience. And so I think that more so than educating on other topics, in some cases, that representative education model is important.
It also seems to me that there ought to be some kind of a campaign, if you will, to change how we think about the social media, or change how you think about it. I remember some years ago when tobacco use by youth was a huge problem. There was an investment in looking at how to mount a campaign that would reach young people, because we know young people don't think they're ever going to die. All they care about what's cool, but What the researchers found in doing focus groups with youth is they said they didn't want to be lied to. And so there was this whole truth campaign that got mounted that was very effective in reducing the use of tobacco and young children starting to smoke in the first place. It was that you are being lied to. You are being deceived. And so it wasn't about whether it was, you know, good for you or not. It's that you were being lied to. And I wonder if that kind of a campaign wouldn't be helpful here.
Well, one thing we saw with the whistleblower, Frances Haugen, who, you know, formerly worked for Meta, which owns Facebook, you know, one thing she said when she testified to Congress, which is powerful, which is just that these companies know. These companies have awareness of their effect they're having on children, and they're continuing anyway. And, you know, again, that's disputed by the companies, but I do think that that was sort of a groundbreaking moment when her testimony was first out there. And as people hear more about that and understand that these companies do have awareness, it does shift their view. I'm totally with you. I'm a really big proponent of cultural change. And so I think that the space right now is navigating the balance of the sort of urgent need to do harm reduction. So actually deal with, you know, what's happening now, educate parents now, and then prevention. So trying to sort of think long term about, you know, how can we change norms and systems so we don't arrive to some of the dark places that we're finding our youth is arriving to. And both of those things are sort of in motion, but the more people are talking about it, I think the more normal it will be to expect to see that kind of campaign.
And if people want more information on some of the sites that you've mentioned or other places to get more information about how to deal with children in terms of social media, what would you recommend?
I'd recommend Common Sense Media and Fair Play Media, and then jonathanhaidt.com/social-media. His name is Jonathan, and then his last name is haidt.com/social-media. Has a really amazing set of resources highlighting all of the research that really connects the dots, and is a great conversation starter for parents and for other people and communities as well.
And give that website one more time.
It's the name Jonathan, jonathanhaidt.com/social-media.
Great. Well, Jory Craig, resident senior fellow at the Institute for Strategic Dialogue, thank you so much for coming on to Health Center in the Catskills and talking about this important topic today. Very helpful.
Of course. Thank you so much.
Have a great day.
Bye-bye.
Bye. Yeah, important information. And, you know, for those of us who are older, we don't know what it's like to grow up in this digital age. We didn't have all of this technology when we were growing up. And I think we have to be mindful that it's a different world for our young people, and we have to be a little bit more understanding and deepen our conversations with young people. I think the evidence can help, and I think being able to talk about it honestly can help. So very important information, and I'm grateful to Jory Craig for coming on today. Well, that's Health Center in the Catskills. You're listening to it on WIOX Community Radio. I'm Diana Mason. Have a great day, and stay cool.